Perfect, yeah. My name's Ed, I'm an alcoholic. I haven't found it necessary to have a drink since January 1st, 1989, and that is only through God's grace. I deny all the allegations that were just made. You know, when he gave me the topic, I thought back, you always have to go back to the beginning. You know, I grew up in a family of eight in my household. By the time I was 15, three kids had passed. One was struck by a car, and two died of a generic disease. Father was an active alcoholic. Mother was an alcoholic. Father was pretty tough on me physically. He was an old World War II vet. Here's a guy who lies about his age, joins the Army or the Navy at 15, goes into World War II. First battle he's in is Battle of Midway. He was an all business kind of guy. I hated him growing up, you know, because everything was directed at me. All the anger, not that I wasn't asking for it, because I was, believe it or not, a disciplinary problem. I know a lot of you find that hard to believe. You know, I was just not a smart kid. I was hyperactive. I was a Ritalin baby, you know, right from jump going through school. You know, a disciplinary problem in school, the whole nine yards. And I figured the Army would straighten me out on that. And they did for a little bit. You know, did 3-year trick in the Army, got out at the tail end of Grenada. I liked the Army because it was regimented. And they gave me a lot of skills. You know, I was, I'm still to this day anal retentive with detail, you know, getting things done the right way, you know, just to a fault a lot of times. But I always wanted to be a cop. Always wanted to be a cop because those are the guys who make the rules. Because your rules didn't apply to me. I was always willing to pay the consequences for my actions growing up. Always willing to pay for them, you know. Always against the grain, the fly in the ointment. Always. So I eventually, when I get out of the service, and that was a miracle that I did not get court-martialed, but I did get out. I was in the infantry, which is where they put all the not-so-smart guys. When I took the ASVAB test to get into the Army, I think I was pretty low on the scale because they said, yeah, we're going to offer you one thing, and that's light infantry. And good luck. And, you know, I can remember just being in with every hoodlum that was in society from all over the U.S. So I wind up getting discharged. I did very well while I was in there. Got the promotion to sergeant, ran a what they call an armament shop, which was making and maintenance on weapons and that sort. And my focus was to be, you know, to get on as a cop. Now, I wanted to do that since I was a kid. I loved watching Batman and Robin get the bad guys, you know. I loved the movies that came out, The French Connection, The 7-Ups, this is what I wanted to be. This, that was the kind of cop I wanted to be. So it turns out that at the time when people were hiring, I was getting beat out by a lot of guys who had college, and I didn't have college. My parents had offered me college, you know, after high school, but there was no way. I hated school, and I was a CD student. I made it. I was at the very bottom of my class, third from the bottom in graduating. I truly don't believe I had enough credits to graduate. I think they said, let's give this guy a pass because we don't need him here for summer school. Legitimately, I believe that to be true. And I was getting beat out by guys with college all the time. And finally, I got in. And I excelled in the academy. It was one thing, it was my dream, you know, to do this. And I did very well. And then there were some things that, you know how we say, I'll never do this and I'll never do that? Well, I swore I would never drink on the job. I'll never do that. So, graduation night comes from the academy, and I'm coming back from a party, and I thought it was a great idea that I was on the highway going home. I was doing like 90 plus because I had a badge and I could do what I wanted. And you know those barrels that they, you know, have out there on the highway? And if you just clip them the right way, they go flying a mile. Well, I was out there doing my thing, and a cop stops me. Of course, the Badge of Merit card comes out, and a guy just looked at me in utter disgust. He was like, hey, are you going to make it home? I said, sure, I'll make it home. Sent me on my way. You haven't even been a cop a day yet, and you're already screwing up. So, I wind up, I got to say, this has happened to so many of my friends. My first year as a rookie was wild, the things that went on. Now, I had been acclimated before the job. I was a part-time cop, and before that, I was a police cadet. So I had a very good understanding of the job. And this is how far my compass was off. We had guys committing suicide, committing homicide, suicide, shooting their wife, their girlfriend, shooting themselves. Guys getting sent away on the farm, which would be rehab. And my thinking at the time as a young kid was, but this is what you signed up for. This is what you signed up for, and if it comes your way, you're just going to have to deal with it. And how, you know, I look back on just how far off the mark I actually was. You know, just comprehending reality. So, you know, when I saw a guy, and many guys did commit suicide, and you know, my feeling was, well, better him than me. You know, that's not going to happen to me. Because don't you know who I am? You know? That arrogance. So, when I see some crazy things happen to me, you know, I can remember one time, and it probably wasn't, it was, you know, it was during my first year. I was always pretty street smart. I was great at reading people, body language. I just knew when something was off. I had that intuition that something wrong was about to happen. You know, something's not kosher. And I didn't even have a year. And I was working a midnight tour, and I wound up stopping this guy on the highway. And the only thing I could tell you is I walked up and looked this guy in the face, and I thought I was staring at Satan himself. He had a face of leather. His eyes were black. Just that hardened look. And I knew I hit the jackpot with this guy. Now, I got to tell you, I was fearless as a young kid. I just, to the point of being reckless. But I knew this guy was going to be a jackpot. And sure enough, he was. He had committed a double homicide. And I always attributed all of this, my arrogance, I always attributed any arrest that I got that I was the one who figured it out, that I was the one who made the arrest. And, you know, I'll preface it by saying, look, I grew up as Catholic. My parents were devout. I was just a cafeteria Catholic. I'd go to Mass because they made me go to Mass. I believed in God, but I didn't believe that he believed in me. And that would change later on. So all these crazy things start happening to me in my rookie year. And the drinking is out of control. When cops get together, we used to call it choir practice. Hey, are you going to choir practice, you know, tonight? And of course, you never miss one of those. And then comes the I'll never drink while I'm working. And I was asked to run a DWI checkpoint. And before I went out, I might add two rock glasses full of VO, you know, just to take the edge off. Because everybody else was doing it, so that makes it right. And I remember this one guy who was, you know, he definitely had a couple of drinks. And I said to him, how much have you had to drink tonight? And he said, you know, I had two. You know, I only had two. And of course, being the sarcastic guy that I was, I said to him, what's Budweiser putting out some new kind of aftershave that I haven't heard about yet? And the guy said, well, maybe you're smelling your own breath blowing back in your face. Yeah, that's a reality check right there. You know, I was sent for a yearly physical, and the doctor came in after my blood work had come back, and he said, hey, let me ask you a question. Do you drink a lot? Because he did a liver cell count, you know, a liver cell check. And I said, well, no more than anybody else. And he said, let me tell you something. Your liver cell count is off the charts for a kid your age. And it didn't sink in, you know? It didn't sink in. Yeah, okay, whatever. If you had my job, you'd drink too. That was the mentality. And, you know, it's an interesting culture in that some of it is deserved and some of it's not, where you're taught it's us against them. It's us against them. And I would later find out that was partially true, but most of the time it wasn't. You know, it really depended on what house you worked in, you know, so to speak. So I wind up, I'm in serious financial trouble. I'm starting to drink on the job. I'd said to people, we always had oxygen in the back of our cars. You know, if you were the first responder and you got there before an ambulance got there, you know, to assist. And these guys couldn't figure out where all the oxygen was going in the units, is because I was driving around from call to call with the mask on my face, trying to clear my head up. And then the end finally comes where it's me sitting on the end of the bed with the pistol in the mouth. And this would happen 3 times. And I always make the description where I'm telling you, I looked down the barrel of that gun. I could see the glistening of the bullet along the side of the barrel. And, you know, I remember just saying to myself, how did I get here? How can this be? I knew my father's brother had committed suicide the same way. He actually killed his brother. They were on their way to the prom and got into a car accident, and he kills his brother. And he was so guilt-ridden for years, he wound up taking his own life, you know. So alcoholism ran pretty rampant in my family, both sides. So I just remember, you know, looking up at the ceiling and asking God to intercede on my behalf. I need help. Please give me help. And the next thing I remember is my father had told me maybe 2 weeks prior to this moment that, he's got some time in the program now. He's been in for a while. He says, hey, if you ever want to go to a meeting that's all cops, I can hook you up. He planted that seed. And I put the gun down on the nightstand and I called him. And it was like he was waiting for the phone call. And I said, Pop, I think I need some help. He goes, I got just the guy for you to call. Call this guy. And I called this guy up. Went to my first meeting at the Orange Firehouse off of by Edison's Museum there in Orange, New Jersey. Walked in. It's all city cops. And these guys just looked at me. Not that I'm sure you couldn't tell with all the bloat in my face. And they said, hey, can you tell us why you're here? And I said, I think I might have a problem with alcohol. And he just said to me, this one old timer, he goes, Sonny boy, anybody can look at you and see you're not here because you have a problem with effing string beans. And I was like, who was this guy to talk to me like that, you know? But they told me to identify, not compare. And by the end of the meeting, I knew I was home. I was safe. These guys had the answer to my problem. I went there for about a year. And I didn't like it because it was war stories. You know, everybody's got war stories. So I wound up going to some civilian meetings. And, you know, I kept hearing this stuff about getting a sponsor, living the steps, doing service. Yeah, I'm not so sure I want to do that. Not yet. You know, I got this. And for my first 3.5 years in the program, I would say it would be one big emotional hangover because I didn't do any of that. And I did have the audacity to walk up to an old timer and said, is this all this program has to offer? And it was what I refer to as a brace for impact moment. And this guy let me have it. Says the guy who doesn't have a sponsor. Says the guy who won't do any service for others. Says the guy who doesn't live the steps. You know, the simple nothing changes if nothing changes. And I wound up getting a sponsor. This guy was a state trooper. He had 53 years of sobriety at the time. He was a true gentleman. And I started getting in the middle. You know, I started doing the deal. You know, when I look back on my career, now I'm sober, supposedly. And aggravating people in my job was part of the territory, but I took it to another level. I didn't realize why I was so angry. And as one woman therapist put it to me perfectly, you know, when I kept coming to her, when I was trying to work my way through the program, and she said to me, "Why are you so angry at all these people?" Because most of the people, 95% of the calls you went on were drugs and alcohol related, at least in the house I was in. It was a violent place. That was just a fact. And she said to me, "Why do you think you're so angry?" And I said, "Well, they won't do what I'm telling them to do." And she said, "No, that's not the answer." I said, "Well, really enlighten me." She said, "You're angry because they can drink and you can't." And I was like, "Whoa, that's what a slap in the face." You know, and that woman would be so instrumental in so many things that, you know, like when they tell you, "Hey, AA is not a cure-all. Sometimes we need some outside help." I needed a lot of help. I needed a lot of help. You know, that first 3.5 years in sobriety with not doing what I was supposed to be doing led me to getting a 4-step done in the newspaper. That was absolutely, you want to talk about incomprehensible demoralization, because I was running my own show and not taking direction from old timers. God had another plan for me. He goes, "All right, sonny boy, you don't want to do the 4-step, the 5th step? I got something for you." And I was in for 2 years of litigation in the newspapers, nonstop, most of it for brutality, the anger, the taking it out on others who weren't following my directions. I got to tell you, I remember walking into a meeting one time. I was front page every other week for 2 years with all these trials I was going through. And one guy comes up to me, goes, "Hey, man, I see you're in the paper again." I said, "Yeah," you know, kind of blowing it off. And he said, "Man, you're really on fire." And I'm like, "Okay, yeah." He goes, "Well, you know why that is?" And I looked at this guy. I was ready to knock him out. "What do you mean? Do I know why that is?" He said, "You're on fire because you're being molded." And I had to stop in my tracks. I was like, "Holy crow. Is God really pointing this out?" And it just turned me in a, you know, around to a point where, you know, when you keep getting clipped all the time for bad behavior, sooner or later, you're going to have to take a look at you. And all those people in those meetings were saying to me, you know, "What's your part in this? What's your part in this?" "Oh, I'm just doing my job. I'm just doing my job." I was far from doing my job. I violated my oath so many times, it was ridiculous. And I deserved to be fired. But you know what shows up when you come in here and you start doing the deal? Humanity. Humanity shows up. You start becoming a human being. And I got to tell you, that's the most painful process I think I could ever remember. When I started looking at things differently, I can remember it was a Christmas day. I was working a day tour. I had a female partner who I did not like. She always led with her chin, you know, and would talk smack to bad guys because you were there to take up the slack kind of a deal. We'd gone to a domestic. Two guys with a woman. It's Saturday morning at 7 o'clock in the morning. They had been partying all night. And we separated them. She went with the guy. I went with the other guy and the girl up on the porch. And I heard her yelling at him. And this guy hauls off and cracks her and breaks her jaw. And I wound up locking the guy up. And this is when humanity shows up. This guy's in the cell block. I'm starting to get my footing in here. I have a sponsor. And this guy is just, he's laying hole shots into me, bringing me down to reality. And I remember one point he made. You are no different than the people you were locking up, only in that you are not taking a drink today. So stop looking down. And the only reason why you should be looking down is if your hand is out to extend them to help them upwards. And that's it. And I remember going to check on this guy in the back cell because he was, you know, aggravated assault on a police officer is not a light charge. And I went back there, and for some reason, it clicked with me. When I went to check on this guy, I said, hey, how you making out? He goes, officer, can you tell me why I'm here? And I was like, you don't remember what happened? He goes, no, I don't know why I'm here. I think it's Christmas. My heart just sunk into my ass. I said, dude, you broke a cop's jaw. And he just broke down crying. I don't remember. I don't remember. I mean, I was a blackout drinker. It's funny because we were talking earlier about how other people, you know, we knew back in the day would come up and tell us things we don't even remember doing. You know, you know, it's happened to me so many times, and so many times along the way. I believe me, I don't do this program anywhere near. You know, I remember just being so uncomfortable in my own skin in the beginning that I would do anything to escape, not take a drink or a drug, but anything. And then it was the women. Then it was sleeping with half the tri-state area just so I couldn't feel the pain of growing up in here, you know, or taking direction, or I just left a tidal wave of so many bad things that I did to other people. And I mean, I'll be honest with you. I think I don't start really getting a clue of how much damage I did till probably at about 10 years where I started figuring stuff out. And another 10 years at 20 years where I really had to focus on the concept of as we talk about making God the centermost point of our life, where we have to depend on Him. I'm the original slow learner, you know. And I'm not smart enough to learn from any of your mistakes that you discuss in a meeting. I had to learn on my own, and I had to be beaten into a state of reasonableness. It just had to be. You know, it's interesting because my sponsor had said to me, you know, because I was just so ego, the gun, the badge, the don't you know who I am. And he said to me one time, he goes, hey, let me ask you something. When you get off your shift, where do you put your badge? I said, well, I put it in my wallet. He goes, where do you put your wallet? I said, my back pocket. He goes, good. Put your pride and ego there too. This guy was so instrumental in drilling me down, or making me drill down to me, you know, to be accountable for my actions. I can remember, you know, and some of the things that happened along the way for me. Some of the things that happened along the way to me, truly God moments. I had gotten promoted to detective. Now I had to learn how to use this instead of these. And it was great. I excelled great in this area. I think they just wanted to take me off the street because they were tired of getting lawsuits all the time. But I remember having a guy who I, this informant that was not very well liked in the area. He was a junkie. And he was telling me he could get into this one particular place that I wanted to buy some automatic weapons. And guys kept telling me not to use this guy. But the ego, that ego. Oh, I got to get those guns. I got to get a little badge, you know, a little medal or whatever. So guys kept warning me, hey, don't use this guy. He's unreliable. So I was going to send this guy in with $2,000. And unbeknownst to him, I had 20 undercover spread out along his route to make sure that he went into the house and came out. And I let him go from the car. I said, I'm warning you. You're not going to screw me out of my money, you know. So he goes past the first checkpoint, second checkpoint, third checkpoint. Hey, the guy didn't come by here. I call it out. The op is off. You see him, take him. Foot chase starts. I catch up with this guy. And the rage in me was unbelievable. I had hit this guy so hard in the side of the face, I split his earlobe. Sent him to jail. He winds up drawing, I think it was like a 12-year sentence for robbery, you know, the whole nine yards. And the wildest thing happened. I had heard that this guy had made a deal before sentence was invoked, that he gave up a triple homicide. And I was like, well, that's great. You know, I'm glad they dismissed charges. A couple of years later, when I was a sergeant out on the street, I was at a fight with a couple of my guys, and this guy walks up to me, and very clean cut, big guy, just like 6'4", very clean cut. He said, hey, are you Detective O'Rourke? I said, well, I'm a sergeant now, but what can I do for you, sir? He said, "You don't remember me, do you?" I said, "No, I don't." He goes, "I'm the guy who ripped you off on that gun deal." And I'm like, looked at the guy, and I was like, it was obvious he had gone clean. He said, "Look, I'm here to make amends to you for what I did." And I stopped him. I said, "Bro, I owe you an amends for beating you up." He goes, "No, I deserved it. No, I deserved it." We're going back and forth. We're hugging in the middle of the street. And my guys are looking over going, "What the hell is this?" They're looking at me like. And you know, that when we talk about slender threads, you hear the term slender threads, how we're all connected by slender threads. Here's another guy. He winds up, he gets locked up by the Midnight Tour for breaking into the wrong house. And they tuned him up pretty good. And I went back there to talk to him. And I was the day tour sergeant. I checked everybody in the back cells. And this guy says, "Hey, Sarge, I haven't had anything to eat in 2 days. Can you send me to the flight deck, you know, the psych ward, and then detox?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." And one good thing about when you started becoming human, you had a captive audience to talk to these guys who were, you know, who wanted help. And I would break my anonymity all the time, you know, once I started figuring stuff out. So I told him, I said, "Hey, look, I'll be back. Let me finish my rounds. I'm taking this guy to rehab." And I tell him about me. And he was shocked. And I said, "Hey, listen, I'm around here in this area. Stop in and see me anytime. You know, I hope you follow through with this." A year later, now I'm up in Jersey. I get a call from my nephew down here at Caron in Fort Lauderdale, who's working intake for bringing people in. He goes, "Uncle Ed, you're never going to believe what just happened." I said, "What's that?" He goes, "Some guy comes in for intake and he reads the nameplate on my desk and he said, 'Man, I remember a cop up in Jersey with that last name.'" And my nephew goes, "Really?" He goes, "Where were you?" He goes, "I was in Dover." He goes, "That's my godfather." The slender threads. And he told him, he goes, "That guy gave me a break. He drove me to the psych ward and then to the rehab." You know, when I finally made God the centermost point of my life, and I'm speaking for me, there's some key things that I read in the book. It's out of Bill's story. "I must turn all things to the Father of light who presides over us all. The central fact of our lives is absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could not do ourselves. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and to people about. If it's one thing I have figured out, if you have a make-believe God, whatever it is, your higher power, you have a make-believe sobriety. I can tell you with certainty that as time goes on in this program, ask any of those old timers back there that as the path gets thinner, the more time you get. And there you are sitting with yourself and you can't lie anymore. You know, it's the difference between, I love how Russell had pointed it out to me one time. There's a difference between "I believe in God" versus "I believe God." Or as I heard one guy say it perfectly, I went from a God I did not understand to a God I understand to a God I stand under. And that's who I stand under now. He is my rock. He is my salvation. He has pulled me through everything. He's had his hand on my shoulder. We live our life forward, but we look at it backwards, as Cindy says. And when you've been around long enough and you start looking at your life backwards and you figure out that you're not here of your own grace, you're truly not here of your own grace. And if you think you are, trust me, keep coming and you'll figure that one out. You know, I saw this and I thought of some of my friends in here. Do I feel like I'm trapped in a kind of prison? Maybe I'm struggling with addiction or feel dragged down by debt. This situation could turn out to be your deliverance. Any hardship I've incurred in here, as they say in the extended version of Serenity Prayer, accepting our hardship as the pathway to peace, has rung true to me every time. You know, there's two prayers I'll leave you with. They're my favorites. Lord, protect us from what we cannot see and what you did not send. And Lord, scatter my pride before my pride scatters me. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to all of you.